Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And welcome aboard. Welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Horowitz, and it's episode number 54. Hoo-wee. We have, we've been doing this about a year. Right about now, it's about a year, and we've had upwards of almost 500,000 downloads in that time. So thank you so much for, being here. Thank you so much for participating. Hopefully you've made some money. I know you've made money. I'm getting emails from people. They're telling me you've made money, and I'm real happy about that. In the last week, some of the recent things that we had talked about have done really well. I had told you about Capital One, and of course it went down to about 45 from 54 or 53 when I told you about it. So hopefully you did cover it in that time. And I do think there's some, I think there's some further downside. As a matter of fact, I think there's a lot of downside, but we're not going to get into that because I beat that horse. Interactive Brokers, which I've told you about, is up about $5 from what I told you. And I wrote about that in the blog if you haven't seen that at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We have some super, super guests today, so I'm going to dispense with a lot of the upfront discussions. Just tell you two things. Number one, this is kind of funny, actually. There's a couple of shows out there that I really like. One of them is Money Girl. I don't know if you've listened to it before, but it just so happens that the Money Girl, a really popular podcast, very short form, where they give advice on all sorts of things, money. Well, they need to substitute a host right now. Well, I'm gonna be the Money Girl for the next couple of weeks or so, a couple of episodes, filling in. And check it out at iTunes, or you can go to qdnow.com and check that out. I'll give you some links to Money Girl as well. So stick around. I think it's coming up next week. You'll hear the first of a few. There's a Fed rate increase or decrease coming up, or decision at least next week. That's important that I want you to know about as well. And the other thing I want to let you know about is that, I told you I've been writing for my research, and my piece have been picked up by AOL. As a matter of fact, I made front page of AOL Finance this week. But also, I'm also writing for Top Stocks at the MSN Money. So that's kind of neat. I'm doing some blogging and some work there and giving an opinion, et cetera. So check that out. That's really neat. I'm very pleased about that. And I'm sure you'll hear a lot more about that coming up. But make sure that you do bookmark and put the RSS feed for the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, because that's where you get a lot of the inter-week discussions on what I'm doing and what I'm recommending. So make sure to go over there and check out the site. Do what you can to participate in that. And do me a favor, please, 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 give me your comments. I'd like to hear what you have to say. So, jot it down on the site. There's all these comments sections there. And also do me a favor, give your comments at iTunes if you like what you're hearing. Let's get right down to it. First up, Greg Ipp. He's the editor and contributor to the Wall Street Journal and also co-authors the Real-Time Economics blog, and is also a frequent contributor to CNBC, amongst others, and really is an expert on the economy and economic fronts. So let's get into a discussion with Greg Ipp. Tell me something. We have the situation that, we have this swapping of good debt to bad debt, where the government's been taking all the junk and the toxic and giving kind of a backing. What does that really mean to us long term?
Well, the financial crisis that has come over the market since last August sort of has two parts. One of them is that we know that there are a lot of mortgages out there that will never be repaid in full because the homes simply don't support the value, and the people who bought the homes and took out the mortgages won't be able to afford them. And so we know that at the end of the day, a lot of these mortgages will be written down or written off entirely. But because the system has become so complex in the last decade, not everybody knows where those bad mortgages are, and that's created basically a crisis of confidence where a lot of banks and financial institutions and investors simply don't want to lend to each other, or only lend to each other at extremely high rates and against extremely good collateral. And therefore, we probably have a system where the risks and the fears go well beyond anything that's actually realistic for what the economy is facing. The Federal Reserve sees it as its job not necessarily to save people from their losses, certainly not to try and put back the value of homes or stocks or anything else back to some level that they were, you know, a year or two ago. But they would like to get the markets functioning normally, so that's something we call price discovery, which is the normal process by which buyers, sellers, and meet and agree on the value of something, can get started. And one way they do that is by saying to the banks and the securities dealers, okay, you have your balance sheet bulging with all these mortgages and mortgage-backed securities. You can't sell them to anybody. You need more money to finance them. You need more money to make new loans. We'll help you out. We'll take those off your balance sheet temporarily for up to 28 days, and you accept them as collateral for a loan that we will make to you that's money good. And essentially, the Fed is saying, we're not buying these toxic waste type assets. We're simply accepting a variety of assets as collateral. If it's the bank that is on the hook for the loan, so if the bank, first the bank would have to default for the taxpayer, that is to say the Federal Reserve, to be at risk. And then after the bank defaulted, then the collateral would then have to turn out to be bad for the federal government to actually take a loss. So the likelihood of there being any hit to the taxpayer involved in these operations is extremely low. A larger question is whether the Federal Reserve, which is after all a servant of the public, ought to be heavily involved in helping markets basically reliquify themselves by accepting this stuff as collateral, no matter how remote the possibility of default is. I think at the end of the day, the Federal Reserve was created 95 years ago to prevent banking panics and financial panics from tipping the entire economy into recession.
Right.
And so while they've had to take steps that certainly go beyond the conventional and the orthodox, as we've understood them to be, they are, broadly speaking, within its mandate to prevent and mitigate financial crises.
Right. So, you know, obviously then, you know, just to back up a second, the comment that, you know, a lot of the things that we're seeing right now may be, you know, a confidence crisis because, you know, there's big concerns out there, et cetera, and people are really not knowing what the end and upshot is going to be. But what about, you know, what about, you know, you talk about the banks, you talk about the, their balance sheets. I'll tell you a quick story. So a friend of mine, you know, has a credit line outstanding, and long story short, he's been a good customer of this bank for many, many years, and all of a sudden the bank decides to just totally say, you know what, you have no more credit. Your credit is going to be, you know, whatever you're at right now in your credit line, that's it. You can't take another dollar. Is that something we're going to be seeing a lot more of, do you think? Or is that, you know, what's happening
yes,
there?
Unfortunately, yes, I think you'll see more of that. And there are several reasons why that's happening. First of all, a lot of credit lines, I don't know what the case is with your friend, but a lot of credit lines are basically home equity lines where the security for the bank is the home of the borrower, which was fine when housing prices were going up. But now that home prices are going down in many parts of the country, the bank is facing the possibility that if their borrower defaults on the loan, the security that they've committed to the loan will not be sufficient to cover the amount. And so that alone is creating a pulling back among the banks and a wariness, which wasn't there a few years ago. The second factor, which is really not specific to any particular borrower's case, is that banks have suffered so many losses on their loans, plus they're being forced to do what we call involuntary lending. For example, they promised to lend, let's say, $5 billion to a leveraged buyout, but on the assumption that they would quickly turn around and sell that $5 billion loan to somebody else. And it turns out they haven't been able to sell it, so that $5 billion is stuck on their balance sheet. And between having to make these loans that they didn't expect they'd have to, and the fact that some of their capital has been eroded, they need to somehow shrink their balance sheet in other places so that they have an appropriate amount of capital for the new size of their balance sheet. And so, unfortunately, they have to be somewhat indiscriminate in that process. And so they're going around looking at a variety of their business lines and reining in lending there. And so across a variety of fronts, whether it's credit card loans, corporate and industrial loans, small business loans, home equity loans, many banks are pulling back. And yes, you will see more and more people discover that the terms under which they were able to borrow before have suddenly gotten tighter.
Which then, of course, leads to the obvious point that if there's not a lot of credit or there's less credit available, and our country has been utilizing it in a major way to fund and you know their daily life, and now that we have you know the commodity you know price increase, you want to call it a bubble, you want to call it just a just an amazing you know realization of the lack of food and oil and whatever it is, the fact is the prices are higher, whatever you want to call it. And now what happens, you know, very shortly, what happens to you know, the average guy who is now having to pay, you know, $75 to $100 to fill up their SUV and, you know, to put dinner on the table. I had a sushi dinner last night with for three of us was $85. I mean, you know, how do we survive that way?
Maybe eat less sushi for starters.
Yeah.
I think you get some fine chicken meals for a bit less than that.
I understand.
But joking aside, I mean, you've put your finger on an important point, which is that we're dealing with two serious shocks to the consumer right now, not one. First is the one we just discussed a moment ago, which is that it's much harder to get credit and therefore to buy anything on credit. And the second is this huge hit to the pocketbook from rising food and energy prices, which is essentially a separate phenomenon going on, which has many multiple causes, and we can get into that a little bit later on. But that's one reason why people at the Federal Reserve, at the Treasury, at the International Monetary Fund, throughout officialdom, are extremely concerned about the economy and have basically dropped any pretense of the notion that we're likely to avoid a recession. There are two very serious risks here, and they are risks that do not have easy solutions in the policy world. Now, the Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates a full 3 percentage points since August to 2.25%. That's helping a lot, although it's not fully filtering through to borrowers because of the reluctance of banks to pass on the savings fully to the borrowers. That would help a lot. The U.S. dollar has declined a lot, and that's providing important support to our manufacturers who can now export more and have a better time competing against.
Yeah, but now we're seeing the dollar come back to sorry to interrupt, but the dollar is back to where it was in January and we're seeing all of a sudden a shift, and the dollar seems to be not rising a lot, of course, but rising, and then you add that to the fact that that was the one, it seems to me, in every report I've read, the one savior of every earnings report has been the low dollar and the ability for international sales to be just making up for all the other problems, right? Do you agree with that?
Well, the dollar's recovery in recent days has been pretty tiny compared to the decline it's undergone in the last 4 or 5 years. And the impact of the lower dollar on our trade patterns does take several years to manifest itself. We have seen a definite improvement in the trade picture in the last year or so, and that doesn't reflect just what the dollar did since August. It reflects what the dollar has basically been doing since 2002. And all the survey evidence we see suggests that U.S.-based companies remain relatively optimistic about the prospect of overseas sales. But look, I don't want to minimize these problems that you've discussed, and the oil and the food hit is definitely an issue. More fundamentally, you have to accept the fact that Americans have been spending beyond their means for quite a few years now, and that's reflected in the fact that we basically borrow about $2 to $3 billion a day from foreign investors in order to support these consumption habits. Now, 5 years ago, that was actually a great favor to the rest of the world, which was in a very weak state while the U.S. was doing somewhat better. Now it's the reverse. The rest of the world is quite strong, and the U.S. is the one that needs the help. And so it makes sense that we would be saving a bit more, borrowing a bit less, and that the rest of the world would be a little bit more enthusiastic about buying our goods and services. And if that process continues in a orderly way, then it would ultimately be better for everybody. And while it's easy to get quite pessimistic about some of the forces at work, such as the housing bust and what's going on with oil, it's important to realize that eventually markets generally do work. They, both buyers and sellers do respond to price signals. At some point, home prices will decline to a level that's more appropriate given, for example, what you can rent a house for, given what the incomes of people are. In fact, we've already seen in some of the hardest hit markets, such as California, a leveling out of home sales. Give that process time, and home prices will eventually find their bottom, and people will have more confidence to go out in there and buy homes. When that happens, the banks and the other lenders will become a little less nervous about the quality of the collateral underlying their loans, and credit conditions will improve. And finally, even energy prices, eventually supply will respond to these signals. And in fact, we have seen the number of acres, for example, under cultivation for crops such as corn and wheat, going up significantly in recent years, responding to price signals. Now, to be sure, a lot of that yield is going into things like biofuels and so forth, but with a lag, it will eventually affect food prices. And plus, there have been some short-term factors at work, such as drought in places like Australia, although stretching into as many years as it has, one can start to wonder whether this really is a short-term temporary impact.
Right. So let me ask you a question. Getting back to the point that Americans are borrowing just an extraordinary amount of money to live, I have been on the bandwagon, and some of my listeners have been, you know, writing me lately, like, Andrew, is there anything good out there? Can you be positive? And I keep on saying, I'd love to be positive. I really would. But right now, I personally believe there's this weird disconnect with the markets, with reality, but that's only time will tell with that. But I have been very concerned about the area of credit delinquencies, you know, the whole area of credit card and unsecured debt, and the ability for these banks to kind of securitize and off balance sheet a lot of their security, their some of their loans, and the fact that there is going to be this huge, I don't want to call it implosion, maybe an explosion of delinquency and default rates in the consumer credit areas, particularly the unsecured credit card area. And we saw Target, for example, come out with a really ugly number this week. And there's been speculation that the numbers can go somewhere as high as 8 to 9%. And I don't see how that's an improbability, do you?
I don't know the details of the specific situations that you've just mentioned with enough detail to offer any sort of authoritative opinion. Right. But I will say that, yes, delinquencies are rising, and that will have impacts. Now, the question is, will they rise significantly more than markets have already anticipated? In fact, the fact that stock markets and financial stocks in particular have rallied on the revelation of increased losses at banks and so forth suggests that investors had already priced in a lot of bad news, and that it may be that the news has stopped getting worse. And remember, you don't need a bottom to be formed when all the bad news is out. You just need the bad news to stop being worse than people anticipated. As right. the old saying goes, markets sell off on mystery and then rally on the history, or vice versa,
right.
when it's history, or vice versa. So, as I said, it's possible to get too overly pessimistic about here. And the and painful as it is, a lot of what we're seeing is part of a necessary process of rebalancing the U.S. economy away from consumption towards saving, away from imports towards exports, and away from borrowing against the value of our homes, and more towards like consuming out of what we earn by producing goods and services. The risk, of course, as always, is that process happens in a compressed period of time and massively overshoots. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Fed is working very hard over time to prevent that from happening.
So do you envision that, you know, is your opinion, do you think that we have heard most of the bad news from the brokers and the financials and the banks and, you know, the people involved in that area? I mean, generally speaking?
I personally really don't know. I don't cover it closely to know. I only know sort of what I see in the news and how the market behaves and so forth. But we do know that, for example, in the credit markets where people buy and sell derivative instruments, which are based on the probability that for one of these big banks will default, that they have priced in a very significant amount of losses in mortgages and so forth, anywhere upwards of $400 to $500 billion alone among financial institutions. And we've had roughly half that amount reported so far. So essentially, we're going to continue over the next year or two to see additional losses reported. What will matter to the markets is whether the losses that they see and other evidence of, for example, behavior in home prices suggest that the losses will be even larger than those worst-case scenarios that are already priced into the markets.
Mm. I guess in closing on this point, and then we don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I guess the thing that just is amazing to me is that 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, the word write-off was a very bad, it was a very, very bad phrase, something you didn't want to get near. And these days, write-offs don't, we seem to be very desensitized to it.
Well, 10 or 20 years ago, when we had primarily a bank-based system, write-offs came very slowly. Banks could basically make the argument that a loan where the where the value of the collateral had gone down would still be repaid somehow, and so they didn't need to reserve against it or write it off. Nowadays, when so many loans actually trade in a market where there are prices readily available, it's much harder to deny to the world that the loan that you own might somehow be impaired. And so that, therefore, and because regulators believe that one of the problems we had in our, for example, savings and loan crisis in the 80s, and that the Japanese had in the 1990s, is that banks were permitted to carry bad loans for much longer than was realistic given the low probability of the loans being repaid. And you essentially had, for example, zombie borrowers being kept alive rather than being cut off, which was essentially an essential part of the creative destruction which revives an economy, while at the same time impairing the ability of the financial institution to make new loans. So what you've got now is the write-offs, painful as they are for the shareholders to endure, actually, in some sense, cull the deadwood from the underbrush and set the stage for the banks to resume lending. So that's not to sugarcoat what the pain could be, and there is a possibility that the write-offs actually go too far because, for example, sometimes when markets become panicked, they start to price in excessively pessimistic odds of a loan being repaid, and if the bank actually has to let that value flow through to its own balance sheet, it will make the bank less able to lend even if the loans actually are pretty good. And so there's some concern about that sort of vicious cycle developing. But
so I'm going to let me just I know you have to go, so I just want to quickly ask you one more thing. First of all, zombie finance, the old you know, kind of keeping dead things alive back in the 90s with Japan.
Yeah.
I want to re-tag that. If you want to use it, fine. I call it, the new thing that we have now, we're calling it Frankenstein Finance. It's kind of trying to reanimate a company and by infusing cash. Okay.
Really? What would an example of that be?
Well, I mean, when I say, you know, you got a lot of, well, for example, look at the Bank of America Countrywide situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we're talking, that was one of the first kind of, you know, situations. At $18, they put in $2 billion to a company that was going to questionably be around for or not be around, you know, in a variety of these other situations where we're having Citibank with a different and a bigger scale and obviously not a dead company, if you will. But, you know, conceptually, you know, the requirement of a cash infusion, you know, from Abu Dhabi of, what was that, $7 billion, that first one that came around?
I don't recall the figure.
So $7 billion here, $11 billion there, whatever the billions are. But it seems, you know, the requirement of having cash infusions to keep these things going, I mean, is there really any difference in the zombie finance back when?
I don't think so. I mean, first of all, the money being infused in these companies is being infused by private parties who are making their own assessment about what the likelihood of being repaid is. And it's equity money. There's no public money at stake. It's not the situation where you have large public loans to these companies and the government is going beating the bushes trying to find anybody that they can browbeat into helping keep the effort alive. I mean, these may be sovereign wealth funds, but they're sovereign wealth funds with a very hard, cold profit motive. They're making a calculated bet that the stock that they're buying at extremely depressed prices will actually be a pretty good investment in the long run.
Yep, I hear you. Well, Greg Ipp, thank you so much for joining us. Listen, everybody can read your viewpoints and obviously your reporting in the Wall Street Journal, but also online at the Real Time Economics blog. We'll make sure to put a link. That's some great stuff you write, and I want to thank you for all the hard work that you do to keep us informed on the economy. Yes, I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
Hi, this is Kate Salter from Investor's Business Daily, and you're listening to Andrew Horowitz on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
So with us now, we have John Markman, who is a really interesting fellow. He's done a lot of writing. He's won a lot of awards, and he is the he's one of the great writers that really uncover some, what I find some really fascinating subjects. He has a newsletter that he calls The Strategic Advantage, and he's also the co-inventor of two Microsoft patents and an author of the best-selling book Swing Trading and Online Investing. He's also a portfolio manager and a senior investment strategist at a multi-strategy hedge fund from 2002 through 2005. We are sure to get some great information from him, and he's one of the lead writers also on MSN Money. So, John, tell me, you know, what is your take on the market these days when we consider all the things that are going on and this, you know, the incredible gaps in food pricing, et cetera? You know, what's your opinion?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm like you, I'm a very disciplined investor. I have lots of opinions about the economy and about the direction of the stock market. But, you know, I created a model almost 8 years ago now, 10 years ago, to help me understand exactly which stocks to buy at different parts of the market cycle. And it's worked so well, I just kind of stick with it. So even though I may have opinions, I may express some opinions to you about exactly what I think, you know, at the same time, I think it's important for people to create, you know, a view of the market that provides them with stocks or bonds to buy that can help them be successful and reach their financial goals over the long term. And so I may say to you, hey, you know what? I think the market's going to trade down now through the from the beginning of May into, let's say, the middle of May. And I may believe that very strongly. But I'm not really going to act on it. I'm just going to buy the stocks that my model recommends and go from there.
So that would seem a little bit counterintuitive that, you know, you're going to believe that the market's going to go down, but still you'll invest anyway. Now, unless you're telling me that your model that you've crafted as a, you know, it builds in a natural, you know, in or out of the market by its very nature, stock by stock. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, my model is risk adjusted, stock by stock. So what we're trying to do is find stocks that are fundamentally sound, fundamentally cheap, have great growth prospects, are under accumulation by insiders, and are also popular. So we're not really trying to be contrarians. We're just trying to find the stocks that are the most likely to go up between now and 6 months from now.
And regardless of sector or overlay for our economic conditions.
That's right. It's not that fancy. You don't have a sector overlay. I don't have a economy overlay. We do have a sector overlay, though. And very often, you know, the model can be very heavily weighted in one sector or another.
Right. I was a little worried there. It sounded like they're coming to get you there.
Well, you know,
in the background.
I work in downtown Seattle, and from time to time, an emergency happens nearby at a hospital, and I get the beautiful sound of a siren going by.
Yeah, I hear you.
So, I have one. I'm in one of the few buildings in downtown Seattle that actually has windows that open, so we get a little bit of extra excitement.
Well, that's good. Well, so let me ask you. So you do a lot of writing for, of course, MSN Money, and I'm sure you know, I just started doing the, you know, on the top stocks. I started blogging this week with you all.
Congratulations! I saw your first entry.
Thank you, and an exciting one at that, I know. And but you know, you've been kind of, I mean, I would say negative. You've been, you know, kind of down, unless it's all tongue in cheek. But I don't think that's the case. It seems like, you know, you have a real negative sentiment on a lot of areas of the market now. Am I getting that correctly?
You know, we have to remember that we have to separate the market, this big word, you know, the capital T, capital mm-hmm. M market, from, you know, sectors and market cap groups and regions of the world that can be successful. So, you know, the market is very heavily weighted in financials. And mm-hmm. I do have a bearish opinion about the banks and mortgage lenders and thrifts. You know, I think that they do have deep-seated problems that are not going to be, you know, brushed underneath the carpet with lower interest rates. We can already see that, that's not working.
It doesn't seem to be that when I get back to the market issue, it doesn't seem like the investors seem to care as much about that.
Well, I mean, in late trading. Investors are per se. If they're just buying the S&P 500, they're going to be disappointed because that's still has a 20% weighting in financial stocks. You know, things like, you know, Citibank and Bank of America and the like. What I encourage people to do is just to pay attention. You know, just to take what the market is selling at any given point and go from there. Right now, the energy stocks, you know, they've had a pretty good run all the way up. People have said they're too high. Energy can't, you know, oil can't go any higher. Gas can't go, natural gas can't go any higher. But they keep going higher. So I just think that you need to concentrate on the stuff that's working and leave all the other stuff alone.
Well, what about the?
You know, I'll give you an example. Back in I started running my model back in the early part of 2000, 2001. And back in 2002, 2001, 2002, the model was constantly buying small regional banks and mm-hmm. Other small value stocks. And people would say to me, why? Well, what's so great about regional banks? And the market wanted them. They had a lot of potential. A lot of them were emerging. They were being taken at higher values, and they were just fundamentally cheap. And when you zoomed forward to 2004, 2005, my model was heavily invested in energy stocks, just like it is today. And just as an experiment, or just for a reminder, I went back and reminded myself of what we were buying back then in 2004, 2005. And just as a way of background, you may recall that 2003 was a fantastic year for the market. But 2004, right. 2005 were really slow. They were, mm-hmm. I think 2004 had finished with a gain of about 9%, but all of that was in the fourth quarter. And 2005 was just barely eked out a gain. I think it was like 5% or so. But all that year, both years, my models were buying the energy stocks just like they are today. And it's kind of interesting because they're the same names, except they're like five times more expensive today. It's Apache at $10, you know, or Anadarko, you know, six times lower, things like mm-hmm. that. So, you know, back then people were saying, it can't go on forever. You know, who's going to pay $40 for a barrel of oil? Then it went to 50. Then it went to 50.
I will.
And then 60. And now we're at 158, and people say, well, it can't possibly get to 125, can it? Well, of course it can.
Yeah. Well, energy actually was 2004. I think it was 25%, and 2003 it was 25%. And obviously, this rotation towards energy has been just amazing.
Well, just look,
it's absolutely
amazing. Anybody who remembers who was investing in the 1970s, were you? Were you investing in the 70s?
I was investing by proxy.
Okay, so your dad was investing, or
correct?
Okay. Well, you know, I was in high school, I think. Then mm-hmm. In the later part of the 70s, I was in college, and I was paying attention to the market. It was harder to trade back then, but, you know, I was paying attention. And I remember so specifically, we had this terrible bear market in 73, 74. Coming into 75, you know, people were still bearish, although the market was recovering. But that whole decade, energy stocks were the bomb. And, you know, by the end of the 70s, it was energy stocks that had gotten to be 20% of the market cap of the S&P 500, not financials. So this can go on for a long time. And people, you know, so I think people need to stop talking about the market and really focus on the things that, you know, can be successful for them.
Well, I've been compulsive about the financials myself and very, very concerned about some of the things. And I, every once in a while, bite into one particular stock or two and start scratching my head wondering what's going on. And everybody knows that listens to me, I've been on the rampage about Capital One Financial. And again, you know, just as an idea, what I don't understand is one thing, and maybe you can help clarify it, about some of these financials, and particularly the credit card companies. You know, we saw recently some earnings came out, and they looked okay. I mean, they looked all right compared to what we thought it was going to be, it seems. You know, investors bid up these some of these financials, but yet the delinquency rate is on the rise, the default rate is on the rise, the write-offs are out of control, and it looks like from all areas the housing issue is not, you know, done yet. And it seems to me that the report that everybody's excited about, or at least when I say when everybody, I mean what it seems that I'm reading between the lines is credit is actually expanding. All these banks are opening up new credit lines and all this great stuff. I'm thinking, wait a minute, if I have a product that is defaulting, you know, a faulty product, why would I sell more of it, right? I mean, if I'm going to know that there's going to be some problems with this.
When you talk about it in the way that you're describing, it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, it all depends on what the reserves are against it. You know, so if they reserve more against potential losses, or if they are doing a better job of hedging against potential losses by taking, you know, in the various ways that they can create derivatives on the fly today, then it makes sense. You know, it's not impossible that they could be expanding credit. But don't forget, you know, they've learned their lesson, I think. From my reading of the Bank of America, National City, and Capital One earnings reports, it seems to me like they are really moving up. They've tried to move up the credit ladder. In other words, they're not taking the people with really lousy credit anymore. You know, we used to joke that, you know, even your cat could get a credit card, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think your cat can get a credit card today.
No, most people can't get credit. I mean, I have stories that I can tell you of people. I live in a rather affluent area in Florida, and
congratulations.
Thank you so much. No, I appreciate that. You know, I like to name drop and things like that. You know that about me. And now I get to name drop John Markman too. So I'm so excited about that. A few people have told me that their banks have actually shut down their credit lines. Not that they've done anything necessarily bad or late or anything like that, but they're just trying to, I think, clean up their outstanding potential, the potential liability that the bank is going to have by knowing a little bit more about the HELOCs that are outstanding.
Well, yeah, HELOC, that's a home equity line of credit, and it's one of those ways that people turn their homes into ATM machines. And, you know, people are always, particularly Americans, are very optimistic. You know, we're always thinking, you know, I'm making X salary today, but, you know, next year I'm going to get a raise, or I'm going to go to this other job and I'm going to make more money, so I'll be able to afford this, you know, home equity line of credit. So I'll just go ahead, I'll borrow against my house, and I'll buy that new snowmobile, or I'll, you know, borrow enough to put on a wing of my house. But then, you know, you do the deed, you get the toy or whatever it is, and then you know, a year later, 2 years later, you realize, oh, my God, I've got to pay this home equity line of credit thing, you know, forever on top of my mortgage. And, you know, it gets a little frustrating. So people miss a payment or two, and their banks get a little uptight, and they send them a notice, and they say, if you miss another one, we're going to, you know, cut you back. And these days, if you do miss one or two in a row, you can get your credit pulled. And that's what's happening.
Right. So to get back to your discussion about that, you believe that the banks have learned their lesson. I mean, somewhat. You know, then I kind of flip over because the modern day marvel of having internet at your fingertips. Your most recent article on MSN Money talks about the fact that, that you believe that as loans dry up, you call it so will the economy. And then you have a couple of sentences in here and you say that the banks seem to be under the impression that hoarding capital to shore up their balance sheets will return them to health. But my sources believe that they are badly mistaken. So some of the things that they're doing in going out and not giving out the credit as they will and borrowing from the discount window, et cetera, you don't think those are going to solve any of their problems?
Well, no. I mean, banks got really, really spoiled in the 2000s. And they got really spoiled because they went out and made loans. And then instead of keeping those loans on their balance sheet and really having to, you know, make sure that Mr. and Mrs. Jones you know, were able to pay up on those loans, whether it was a home equity line of credit or a mortgage, they sold them to brokerages like Bear Stearns. They sold the loans to brokers like Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch, who then packaged them up into things called asset-backed securities. And those asset-backed securities, the asset in this case being the mortgage or the HELOC, and they sold those securities to, let's just say, just to be broad, unsuspecting buyers in Europe and Asia. And that was the, really what fueled the, a lot of the boom of the 2000s, the credit boom. But now as those loans have become, has a lot of people stopped paying on their loans, you know, either they've gone delinquent or they've gotten slow in their payments. A lot of those, as you know, a lot of those asset-backed securities have been downgraded by the rating agencies. And the people who bought those loans are saying, I'm talking about the Asian and European pension funds, are saying, mm-hmm. what the heck? Why did I get sold? This was a hoax. This was a joke. I'm not buying any more mm-hmm. of those. Mm-hmm. And so the banks are not able to basically go out and make any old kind of loan, make a quick profit on it by selling it to the brokerage. They have to make loans that will really, that they're absolutely positively sure will be paid back because they're keeping them on their balance sheets. And that's where the disconnect is coming. Mm-hmm. They have to make better loans. And in fact, they need, what they need to do is go back to plain old, you know, brown paper bag banking. Plain old banking.
Maybe even have a loan officer in the bank that you can actually talk to, but that may be a little bit much
to deal with. The thing is, the other type of banking is a lot more lucrative. You don't have to have, and you don't have to pay experienced loan officers who can look people in the eye and determine whether they're a good credit or not. Right. You know, when you're just selling off the loan, and you don't have to have the risk of that thing sitting on your balance sheet. So it's more expensive and it's a little bit more risky, and so they're cutting back on the people that they're going to lend money to. Now, that's a real problem because it restricts the number of things that people can buy, you know, whether it's a plasma TV or a new house, and it restricts the abilities of particularly small businesses who depend on lines of credit to expand their factories or to get them through soft periods. It, you know, it really restricts their ability to grow. So, and that's why, you know, I think that the economy does have an opportunity to really slow down here. Maybe not, you know, go into this long, horrible recession that people are talking about, but definitely a period of, you know, 0.5%, 1% growth that will sort of feel like a recession compared to what we were experiencing, you know, 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah. So what do you think about the food companies? I mean, you're still relatively positive on some of the, you know, the distributors of, you know, various, you know, whether it's the rice, you know, the Monsantos or even the corn and, you know, Archer Daniels or any of the, you know, places that have the fertilizers, the potashes and the mosaics and, you know, that whole genre of food companies. Is that your model showing those as a place to be investing?
Yeah, my model's like the basic materials of the food chain, not the upper end of the food chain, you know, the Archer Daniels, not so much the food makers like not the food makers like Kraft or Conagra. Those companies are really having a hard time because their margins are being constricted. See, they're paying more for everything. You know, they're paying almost everything. They're paying more for, you know, energy for their trucks, and they're paying more for the corn that, you know, the flour that goes into the Oreos. But at the same time, you know, with wages relatively restricted, they can't raise prices as much as they'd like to. So they're kind of caught in between. And so the food packagers, I think, are really not the place to be. Right now, the place to be is the fertilizers. It seems like an old story now in some ways, but I guess only because I've been talking about it for several years. But, you know, the fertilizer sounds like a gross and sort of unattractive business, but it's very much like energy. You know, fertilizer has is made up of a raw material, three raw materials, nitrogen, potash, and in some cases sulfur. And potash is only, you know, there's only big deposits of it in a few different parts of the world. Two of them happen to be in Canada, one in Saskatchewan and one in New Brunswick, and both are owned by this company called Potash of Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. When you look at a name like Potash of Saskatchewan, you go, huh? You know,
yeah, it's like it feels like overalls.
Yeah, it sounds ridiculous. But, right. You know, it's a funny name. It's a big deal. You know, just think of it as, you know, the company that makes a product that makes the ground more likely to grow corn and rice and soybeans more efficiently. That's all.
Yeah, on the other hand, it has a funny symbol, too, because I went home and I said to my wife, you know, I bought some pot today, and the kids looked at me all kind of funny.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Dad bought more pot.
Right, I got a whole load of pot now.
Well, if you'd have bought a whole lot of pot, you know, 5 years ago, they'd really be happy with you. Then you could buy your snowmobile without having to go get a HELOC.
Yeah, it is amazing. So, is this kind of the picks and shovels approach to the food issue? Is this, you know, where you don't want to maybe be in the foods,
but picks and shovels? It's more like the wood of the handle of the pick.
Mm.
You know, it's raw material. It's energy. It's the stuff that makes the other stuff go.
Right. It's the baseline of the whole food chain, or life chain, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of got accustomed to the whole picks and shovels concept when it came to the internet. That's why we said, you know, go buy Cisco, don't buy Amazon, let's say.
Right.
It's a little different here. This is a raw this is a raw material. It's a commodity. It's a demand-driven product. You know, there's this limited amount of it in the world, and you can't fake it. So to the extent that there's more, you know, there's a rising demand for this commodity, you know, the price is going to go up and margins just swell. I mean, the margins for the potash business are fantastic right now. Why wouldn't that be a great place to invest?
Mm-hmm. Let's skip over from the market, capital M market, and talk about the Strategy Lab. This is something that you developed, I believe, and way back when, a number of years ago, to bring together. Well, why don't you tell about it a bit? It's better through your voice, the founder.
Father of Strategy Lab.
The king, yeah, the king of Strategy Lab.
Right. Well, you know, I was very intrigued by a series of books that were written by a guy named Schwager back in the early 90s. And what he did is he just went out and talked to a variety of investors, value investors, growth investors, momentum investors, and tried to find out exactly what made their strategies work, you know. What exactly was it that made you successful? How is it that there could be so many different strategies that could be successful in the market? And in some cases, ones that were completely oppositional to each other. And so I thought, wouldn't it be fun if we could get, you know, six traders doing different strategies and having them perform in front of the world on the internet in real time? And we could see, you know, we could really see which strategies worked. And the most important part of the lab concept was that they would have to write about their strategies on at least a weekly basis so that they could explain themselves to the public. Now, there's one thing that really makes this work, and that is that there's a strange connection between the desire and ability to write and trading. For some reason, there are more traders who can write than maybe any other profession. I don't know why. It's just some sort of compulsion amongst traders to be able to write.
Hmm.
I mean, you don't see a lot of, let's say, plumbers writing about plumbing. You don't see a lot of doctors writing about doctoring. But there are hundreds of traders who love to write about trading. And the lab is an opportunity to listen in on the conversations that they're having with either their subscribers, if they have a newsletter, or their clients, if they have management clients, or just the conversations that go on between traders themselves.
Yeah, I think you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I know that when I am doing research, it always ends up being, and that's what started my blog. It was all about, you know, how do I really do a better job at cataloging all my research? And I looked at the opportunity to do a blog, and I said, wow, you know, that's interesting. You could date order it, you could tag it, you could do all these things. And then I said, well, I might as well have it out there for my clients. So that's kind of way back when, where it all started. And in terms
of the early
writing,
days of blogging, when was it, like 2 years
ago?
Yeah,
way back. No, I'm talking about, about a year ago, way back. I'm talking about 12 months, actually, 365 days altogether.
Wow. You're a veteran.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. It's been hard. But I think that the idea of researching and kind of putting it down and through your fingers, you know, you're using the computer to do some of the research anyway, it makes sense. So so now you're in whatever strategy lab you're in now. You have six players in there now.
Well, we've had 10 years of labs now, and so it's kind of interesting to see, to look back and see which strategies have worked and which ones haven't. And, you know, you know, sort of categorize the success rates and, you know, sort of understand what makes people successful in the lab.
What have you found?
Well, I found that the people that are the most consistent are the ones that can be most consistently successful, and I mean not just win one round, but the next round and the run after, are the ones that have a systematic strategy.
Or disciplines, as I like to call it.
Or discipline strategy. I like this guy, John Reese. He's got, what do they call him, the guru investor?
Yeah, I think that's his name, yes.
Yeah, and he just, you know, what I really like about John is that he does the same thing month after month. He's in the lab this, I don't know how he's doing this time, but the last couple of rounds that he was in there, he's always, you know, number one or number two, maybe number three, but, you know, he just gets it done. Right now, he's up 8.5% in this span, the market's up 5%. So he's up 3 percentage points higher than the market. And he's number two amongst the six traders. And that's where he always is, you know, and he doesn't vary from the strategy. He has a model that says, you know, these are the 10 or 20 best stocks to buy in any given month. He buys them. Then the next month comes along, he sells the previous ones and buys the new 10 or 20. It's a very, very smart methodology. And it's the one that I use myself.
Yeah, that's.
I just want to point out that there have been other traders that have been successful, but only that they typically have a hard time repeating their success. They'll have one, you know, good 6 month period, and then you put them on the next 6 months, and they're like, either they're average or at the bottom of the pack.
Yeah. It's the repeatability, and it's the ability. That's the whole point of a process and a strategy is to make it an ongoing. That's the whole point, and to make it an ongoing, repeatable process that can be done over and over with your eyes closed.
I would say that there's a lot of people who say they have a strategy that really don't.
Mm-hmm.
They're really just stock picking. There's lots of really good stock pickers out there, but it's stock picking. And I prefer gentlemen, people like John, who have a repeatable, consistent, provable strategy with a track record.
Well, I'm going to have to put my money where my mouth is shortly, it seems. So we'll see how that works out.
What's your strategy
going
to be?
Well, we've kind of talked about a few different things, but we're going to be basing it on the screening process, where we're going to utilize a couple of different screening overlays. I may do two, actually, you know, kind of back-to-back, so we can kind of bring in a value orientation with a strategy that's going to, well, let me just kind of back up for a second. So we're going to utilize the MSN Money Screener as a backdrop to pulling up and finding a quant process, which is what I do first in my book. And we're going to utilize a process that's going to bring in a value oriented, so in other words, not a go-go growth, not a GARP kind of process. And then from there, what we're going to do is put a variety of overlays that are going to bring in analyst upgrades, earnings momentum. So it's going to be kind of a modified value, but with some growth underlying. So it's, again, not GARP per se, but it's going to have that. And then, you know, we're going to utilize which I do all the time anyway, is utilize the fundamental overlays, and then finally use a technical indicator for the buys, which is identical to what I talk about in my book. So that's kind of,
Tested it over a variety of market trades.
The way I'm going to do it on this one is not. No. Although I could probably do a back test on it before I get there, but I don't think the screener actually can help me with that.
You can test some strategies over at the Wealth Lab unit of Fidelity. They don't have a lot of fundamental indicators, but you can do a lot of testing over there.
Right, we have a couple of different ways that we do it also in terms of some of the backtesting. But I will, it depends. I have a couple of different things I have 3 or 4 months to figure out the final how we're going to work
testing
this.
Testing is a funny thing. I've done, dozens, hundreds, thousands of tests over the years. You know, it's kind of an interesting process. You know, you really got to keep it very loose so that you keep, your model or your strategy can work in all kinds of different periods and not just the past period in which may have a particular orientation that would spit out a type of stock, but not really be successful in whatever next period is coming up.
And the biggest problem I have with the back testing is whether or not the inclusion of the stocks that you're utilizing are actually included in the back test system. You know, there's whether there's stock splits or whether there's mergers, acquisitions, whatever it may be. You know, the big question is that. That's
probably
a big
getting
problem.
A little bit more detail than your listeners want to hear about. But you know, testing has a lot of pitfalls. You know, you're describing one of them. There's, and that is the data. The data has to be clean, and it has to be provably clean. And that's not easy to get. It's pretty hard to get good data.
I hear you. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your wisdom. And I appreciate the ability to now, kind of drop your name around town that I had this conversation with you.
And likewise, it's something I can drop your name amongst all the. what's a good name for like the glitterati of podcasting? The Potterati?
That's right. They call me some. You know, there's a guy named the Podfather, like an Adam Curry, and they call me the. A couple guys call me the Potterino.
All right,
the Padrino.
I'll just say, I had a discussion with the Potterati of was it Florida?
Florida,
the good
yeah.
part of Florida, mm-hmm. not the part with all the foreclosures.
Of course, we're on the western part of it, the higher end. We don't go do foreclosures. They just burn the houses over here. So, hey, thanks a lot. We'll talk soon. I appreciate it, John Markman. And look for John on the MSN Money. He's a great writer over there at MSN Money. And the Strategy Lab, of course, will have all this information on the show notes for this podcast.
And don't forget my newsletter.
We'll make sure to put all of that on there. We'll put a nice
fat
link.
JohnMarkman.com.
JohnMarkman.com. We'll put a big fat link right to your newsletter on the website when this goes up this weekend.
Coming up, the Zach Zone. New issues and IPOs. Ripe, ready, and researched.
The Zach Zone with Zachary Scheidt. Zach is a portfolio manager at Stearman Capital and blogs at ZachStocks.com. Hey, Zach, you had quite the week last week. Wow. Right on with Chipotle, and you had some great IPOs. I mean, just a really good week. Great job. So what's going on this week?
Okay, Andrew. Well, I promise I won't sing for you this time.
Okay.
Sorry, I think last time my voice may have damaged some of your equipment, so you can just send me the bill on that
and on the way.
Put it on my tab,
okay.
I guess. But
no problem.
Anyway, tell me this. Have you ever tried to drink from a fire hose?
Mm.
Just get a little sip here and there?
Yeah.
It doesn't work
no,
that way. Well, that's what the new issue market is like right now. In the past week, when everything was said and done and the closing bell rang on Friday, we had four IPOs priced and at least five different stocks issue secondary shares. The data's still out on that. I'll have to look through some of the papers and find the total numbers. But there were at least five of them that we were participating in.
Mm-hmm.
The IPI, Intrepid Potash, that we talked about last week,
it was a huge
success. It was up 57% in the first day.
Quite amazing.
In the first day, 57%. It actually finished the week with a new closing high, but the stock's very expensive here. They priced it above the range. It traded up from there. It's not at a place where I think it's worth buying right now. So
okay.
If you got stock on the deal, that's wonderful. I did, and I've sold half my position, and I'm holding the rest of it. But I wouldn't suggest buying more at this point. American Waterworks was another one that we talked about, and I thought they would price it right, and I thought it would pop, and I was wrong. They actually did lower the price on it. They priced it below the published range, and that was supposed to bring enough investors in to hold it up okay, but it did not. The company's not profitable. It's really tough to get people interested in a name that's not making money, no matter how interesting the sector is. And so this is a name that if you have stock in, I'm not sure that I'd be holding it too much longer. I got a bunch of stock on the IPO just because that's how the game is played. You have to take the good stuff along with the bad stuff, or you have to take it the other way around. You know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, I have some stock. I've had to get rid of it. It's a little difficult to get rid of, and you just have to take your lumps. But the new issues market doing well, especially with the IPI and some of the other names that that have done well this week, just shows that there's liquidity in the market, and there is opportunity to make money on the long side. We've talked about the overall economy and how the dark clouds are out there, and I agree that they're out there, but it's not raining yet, and so you have to be willing to make some money on the long side as we move to new highs. Looking up to next week, there are some interesting deals in the pipeline as well, and that just goes to show that there continues to be liquidity.
Which is amazing.
One interesting name that, Andrew, you've been involved in is Interactive Brokers.
Yeah, I love them.
I'm sure you saw that they reported earnings
awesome.
On Thursday.
Yep. We recommend them here.
They were great. They were double, actually, what they earned in the same quarter last year. And the news was real well received on the market. The stock did very well. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that they've filed to sell additional shares to raise capital. So that's another secondary offering that we'll be involved in. I think that this is a technical break higher that you need to buy the stock. So I'll go on record saying that I think Interactive Brokers mm-hmm. is a good spot
right.
To own right now. And then the last thing I want to talk about is a name that we hit 2 weeks ago, the Chipotle Mexican Grill, CMG.
Mm-hmm.
It did report earnings on Thursday. Ooh. And well, actually, it was Wednesday night before the open on Thursday. And what happened was the company came out and said things are going well. It's a rough environment, but we're making money. We're growing our sales. We're increasing our same store sales, our same restaurant sales, and we're guiding things to continue to be okay. And yet the stock still dropped 10% on Thursday, as the good news wasn't good enough to satisfy investors. Now this is a wake up call. I think when you see good stocks drop on good news, it's definitely time to either be short or at least be on the sidelines. I've got a nice profit in the short position that I took, and I'm holding my shares because I think we're going to see further weakness. The other thing is we talked about the overall market holding up right now, that the clouds are out there, but it's not raining. If it starts raining, you better watch this name carefully because it will implode. I think that that we could see much lower prices. As much as I respect the company, as much as I like the management, as much as I love their food,
and it's kind of out of their hands.
I think we've got a problem here, mm-hmm. and we could see much lower prices if this market turns down. If the market doesn't turn down, it'll still be fairly weak. To find ideas on both sides of this coin, come visit me at zachstocks.com. That's ZACHstocks.com. And we will get back together next week and talk about Interactive Brokers and how well they did when they issued their shares and whatever else came up in the secondary markets, as well as the new IPOs that are priced next week.
Perfect.
Andrew, thank you.
Hey, thanks, Zach, so much. We'll see you next week. And that's going to wrap it up for the Disciplined Investor. Make sure to check out Money Girl this week, where I told you I'm the guest host. It should be kind of fun. And no, I'm not going to wear a skirt. Somebody asked me about that the other day. But make sure to visit me there and check out, please do check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I have all the information on this episode, how to get John Markman's information, links to Greg Ipp, links to Zach Stocks. And I want you to check out the new site. It went up last week. And do me a favor, email me. Tell me what you think. AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll see you real soon. Be well, be safe. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.